This episode of the Ed Curation podcast is sponsored by Reading Eggs, the multi-award-winning literacy solution fully aligned with the science of reading. Designed by educators for students in pre-K through fifth grade, Reading Eggs is ESSA certified and backed by independent research. Discover why over 16,000 schools choose Reading Eggs and access a free trial or customized pilot for your district at edcuration.com.
You're listening to the Ed Curation podcast. We're bringing you stories from educational leaders about the instructional resources, practices, and movements that are reshaping learning.
I was sort of a classic high school teacher in that I entered the classroom with my love of Shakespeare and To Kill a Mockingbird and sort of the classic canon. And I was shocked and appalled by how few of my kids could actually read those texts when I entered the classroom. After a number of years, I decided to take on the struggling reader class for entering ninth graders that were two or more grade levels below. And after having a year or so of teaching them, I learned that I was the weak point. And as a classically trained high school teacher, I really had no idea how to teach struggling readers other than to say, sound it out, and then to say that again louder when they struggled to do that. I had no idea really how to teach kids to read. I wasn't trained to do that.
Hi, everyone. This is Christy Hemingway, your host. And unless you've been wearing some heavy-duty, high-quality earplugs, you've heard the hot and ongoing controversy about the fact that so many of our students in the United States, even our high school graduates, can't read. Sometimes not at all, or not at grade level, not proficiently, and not well enough to prepare them for college and careers. Not because they're lazy, not because they haven't tried, but because so much of our instructional practice and strategies and resources have not been based on the research-backed practices that lead to success in literacy for all learners. There are a lot of people trying to understand and address what's gone wrong and to fix it. Being a provider of high-quality instructional resources, we at EdCuration want to be part of that solution, and so we're talking today to Dr. Charles Dana Hall, the Chief Academic Officer and co-founder of Sterling Literacy Consulting. After Dr. Hall's experience with the high school struggling readers class, he returned to school himself to earn a master's and doctorate in reading and literacy acquisition.
It was during that time that I also worked in the local schools, and I worked in the elementary schools and in the middle schools with teachers, with struggling readers, and really was able to combine my classroom learning at the university with real world practice as a coach and as an interventionist. So it was a perfect training for moving forward and helping implement the science of reading in real world settings, which is what I do now.
If you're listening and your particular niche is not in the area of reading, literacy, or even education, you may not have caught a crucial point in Dr. Hall's story, which is that secondary teachers, grades 6 and above, are not trained to teach kids how to read. They are trained to teach literature, but if kids arrive into middle school and high school still not decoding words or reading multiple levels below grade, those teachers are at a loss in how to help them get caught up, as Dr. Hall, who goes by Dana, described. It was partly to fill this, among other instructional gaps, that Dr. Hall founded Sterling Literacy Consultants.
After graduate school, I moved to Colorado, and I worked on a Gates Foundation grant at CDE, Colorado Department of Education. And in that role, I really helped lead the rollout of the Common Core State Standards, as well as help provide feedback in the development of the READ Act, which is Colorado's K-3 screening and diagnostic assessment and dyslexia legislation. So I helped provide feedback on that, and it really helped me to learn about teachers' needs for understanding and learning about the science of reading and how to implement these things that were coming down the pike. There were lots of policies being mandated for teachers for which they were not trained to implement. I really, in my predisposition to be so teacher and student focused, I saw a real need in the field for a set of consultants who both knew the science and knew how to contextualize the science for teachers. And we've been largely successful in doing that in Colorado, in Iowa, and across the country. We've really specialized not in helping teachers use a particular program, but in helping them expand their body of knowledge so that they can see the science of reading and how to implement best practices, regardless of the programs that their district may or may not have selected.
Yeah, so you're focused on strategies and pedagogy. Can you give us a snapshot of what it looks like for Sterling to go in and work with a school or district? What are you doing?
Well, it really can include a lot of different things. A lot of our work often starts with an audit where we'll tour the school and do school observations of core instruction, interventions, the MTSS process, do those observations alongside the school leadership and or district leadership so that we can get an understanding of what's currently happening. We don't want to be the type of consultants that come in with answers before understanding the context. So we really try to make sure that we spend a lot of time front loading our understanding of the school system, the curricula that has been selected, the current processes and procedures that are being utilized in the district. And then we expand from there and we try to target whatever we believe is the most important issue. Often core instruction is the first thing that we are tackling and helping teachers and principals understand how to implement well and with fidelity. And after that, we expand to interventions and sort of that MTSS process and using data to drive instruction and meet the students' needs.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you start with an audit because it's so important that teachers have good, solid curriculum in their hands that is aligned to the science of reading, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But before we do that, maybe you have a favorite success story that really gives us the picture of the benefit to a school or district in having this expertise and maybe bringing in consultants who can do this kind of work with them and with their teachers.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Really, my favorite stories are the school level stories and even the classroom level stories, honestly. But the school level story that I would like to tell is the story of Elkhart Elementary in the Aurora Public Schools. They have traditionally, year after year, about 65 to 70% second language learners, about 95% free and reduced lunch. So they're a highly impacted school. And at the end of my time working with them, they moved from priority improvement to performance, which is the highest rating in Colorado. They maintained that performance standard after I left, which is something I'm proud of, helping them establish some sustainability practices. They maintained priority status for 10 years, which no one else with those demographic descriptors can claim. So, and then they've exited the highest percentage of minority boys off of READ plans in the state of Colorado, and they've won the Center of Excellence Award for Colorado. They are a shining example of what is possible using the science of reading systematically over years to make a difference for all students, regardless of their ethnicity, their socioeconomic background, or any other things that are often used, to be honest, as excuses by educators for why we can't meet the needs of these students. Something I'm very proud of as a consultant is that 100% of the people that work with me as my consulting team were once clients. We believe in treating teachers and each other the right way.
Would you say that there were some specific factors, I guess, that made that experience so successful? Why did it work so well at Elkhart?
I think, honestly, one of the big keys early on was taking a coalition of the willing and then using their data to demonstrate the value of the work. Really making sure that all of our steps were based in student data, and not based on my opinion or someone else's opinion, but making sure that we're making decisions based on what the students are showing us is or is not working for them. And then luckily what we were able to show is that the teachers that were sort of getting on board with implementing the core curriculum that was aligned to the science of reading and doing so in a way that maximized student engagement and repetitions of practice and that connection to the text that came later and really having meaningful engagement with that core programming did result in improved performance in students in their assessment data at mid-year and end-of-year data. And being able to demonstrate that really made it non-negotiable for those who were reluctant to get on board that what we're doing here is working. And right. If you care about what's best for kids, let's all get on board and move forward.
Dana shared with me that the principal at Elkhart Elementary, Ron Schumacher, was uncompromising in his vision and determination to adopt best practices for literacy instruction across the board and get every student reading at grade level or above.
People who refused to get on board were invited to work elsewhere at the end of the first year, at the end of the second year. And so that honestly, by the time we were in year three, we only had people that were on board.
I love that.
He had the guts to do that. That made my work as a consultant much more valuable because I wasn't working to make sure that people were on board. I was working to make sure that they were implementing the practices successfully.
It's a strong leadership lesson, right? Like,
I agree.
This is who we are going to be. This is what's important to us. These are our goals. If you don't support those, this is not a fit for you. Good luck. All the love. You know, I hope you find someplace where you can do you, but it's not going to be here.
That's right. Ron had a very strong sense of who he wanted Elkhart to become in this process and gained more understanding of the science and reading throughout the process, which then allowed him to be strong with his decision making as far as who was going to stay and who was going to be replaced at the end of the year.
Do you know what I think too, Dana, is that it almost makes it, I feel like some leaders have fear around that because we're in a teacher shortage right now, right? And they feel like it's better to hang on to a teacher I have and try to, you know, support them and incrementally move them toward these kind of shifts as I'm able to, than try to hire a new teacher who, and I may or may not be able to. But I think strong leadership and a leader and a teacher or a district who knows who they are, who knows what their vision is, and who is going to do everything they can to support that vision is so appealing to a candidate. Teachers want to work for strong leaders who have a vision, know what it's about, and are moving toward it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And it makes a difference in culture. It makes a difference in school climate. It makes a difference long term. And unfortunately, as you say, in my experience, many school leaders aren't strong enough to ride out those difficult first few years, or they don't have the district support to be afforded the opportunity to do so. But I agree with you that school level leadership to really maintain focus on the vision is a non-negotiable to true turnaround success and to implementing the science of reading.
And why should any leader have to apologize for saying, we are not okay with our kids not being able to read? Literacy is the foundation of all other learning, and we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that we reach that proficiency and we meet that goal. I mean, shouldn't that just be a given?
That's right. And what you see with the Elkhart story is that those leaders that are provided the support to implement and to get the faculty that they want and need on board over those first few years of implementing turnaround practices, eventually the story becomes non-negotiable. So you see, you know, winning those awards and having 10 years of performance with 95% of kids on free reduced lunch plans, that story makes your beliefs true. That story is a non-negotiable for parents, for community members, for board members, for superintendents. Everybody sees the truth in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So give us a picture. You said that the audit is the very first thing you do, because if you have a curriculum that's not aligned with these practices, they're not going to be able to shift. But then it's all about strategies and pedagogy and getting teachers on board with the vision. What does that look like?
So a lot of times, even as teachers are making these shifts, we'll say, for example, Christy, we want you and your team to make sure that you're using a physical anchor when you're teaching kids phonemes. Well, then one teacher will tap their fingers and another teacher will tap their arms and another teacher might do something on the board. What we really tried to do at Elkhart and were successful in doing is trying to make sure that we were consistent across grade levels and even more importantly, vertically, so that we could make sure that as kids move, for example, from K to one, that they weren't spending their cognitive resources to learn a new process for counting phonemes, for example, but they could focus on learning the new phonemes. If we are requiring kids to learn new processes for phonemic awareness, phonological awareness, phonics work each year, or even within different teachers, or when they go from the interventionist to the core instruction, if teachers are using different language and different anchors, it's going to be more a heavier cognitive load for students, particularly right. for those students who are already identified as struggling. I personally have interviewed seventh grade students who have said to me in the interview, well, I go to my interventionist and that's where I segment and blend words. That's where I sound stuff out. And then I go back to class. And at no point do they recognize that, you know, my core teacher should be
integrating all of that.
Integrating and talking to me about the fact that when I run into some of these multisyllabic words in science, I can use the same approaches I use in intervention time to chunk that word. Really, one of our success stories at Elkhart, I feel, was trying to really be consistent with those processes, procedures, and even the verbiage that teachers were using in implementing the science of reading. It's about the consistency so that the cognitive load becomes focused on the content, not on the process.
I think this is where things break down in middle school, right? Because learning is even, if it's siloed in elementary school, it's even more siloed. Like,
oh, for sure. Absolutely.
You know, in middle school where kids are literally going from class to class to study different content, how does your work look different at the middle school level with teachers who have not been trained to teach reading and kids who still aren't decoding with, and especially with this siloed learning challenge?
Well, we try to have, middle school is a challenge, as is upper elementary at times, because the Matthew effect is occurring, right? The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting, are maintaining their difficult performance or their struggling performance. It becomes a two-sided approach. We have to make sure that interventions are in place and that there is a safety net in place in these grades to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the struggling readers where they are. I often have recommended a struggling reader class at middle school and even at ninth grade and 10th grade levels where the emphasis of that class is not about the ninth grade standards, for example, but it's about teaching that kid who is in there and reading at the third grade level how to move forward with their skills, so that they can then complement that learning and hopefully translate that into the rest of their ninth grade curriculum. So that's one step. Another step is trying to make sure that the teachers are learning more and more about the science of reading, even if it's three or four small pieces. For example, let's look at our vocabulary words and chunk them into our into syllables. All middle school and high school teachers, or even all the way down, honestly, should be teaching vocabulary explicitly and teaching to recognize the chunks within the words that carry meaning, because a lot of times those chunks can be similar in the cognates that are similar in Spanish and in English.
Yeah.
So a lot of those things are necessary at all grade levels, but especially as we move up. All students need instruction at the middle school and high school level in academic language. The language of academia. What do we mean when we say deconstruct a text? What do we mean when we say analyze a poem? Things like that, the academic language of a particular content area, which brings us to disciplinary literacy. We really try to make sure that the middle school and high school teachers become more involved in this process by empowering them to understand that I can't teach your students how to read, write, and communicate like a mathematician, because I'm not one.
Right.
I need you to really understand how literacy is used in your discipline so that you can teach your students how to read, write, and communicate like a mathematician, like a historian, like a scientist, because that's not what I do. In the past, people like me have really focused on saying things like, everybody's a teacher of reading, to which those teachers often bolt.
Yeah. And justifiably, because they weren't given the information.
Right.
You know,
right. I was one of them. I understand it.
Yeah. It's funny. I was certified when whole language was the flavor of the month. So I was not trained around the science of reading practices. For those people, those teachers out there listening who literacy is not their discipline, or who weren't lucky to be in a teacher program that trained them, you know, around the science of reading. Can you just unpack that a little bit for us?
I'll do my best without trying to sound too much like I'm giving a Merriam-Webster's definition here. But the science of reading encompasses the study of how individuals acquire reading skills, the ability to read and comprehend text, the cognitive processes involved, the areas of the brain, how information is processed during the reading process, the differences between a reader's brain and a non-reader's brain. All of these things are a part of the science of reading and explores various factors that influence reading outcomes like phonological awareness, vocabulary development, fluency, comprehension. And understanding the science of reading has proven to be critical for educators and researchers as they continue to refine and develop curricula and interventions that are in the best interest of students because they're aligned to the science of reading.
Got it. So there's the question of differentiation, because I think the impression is that it's the struggling readers who need curriculum or training that is aligned to the science of reading, and that a portion of our students, a la whole language, right, will just sort of absorb it magically. Are these the instructional strategies that are essential for every emerging reader?
Absolutely. Learning these fundamental foundational skills like phonological awareness, phonics, decoding skills, these are critical skills for all learners. The difference is some students just learn them quicker and easier than others, but all people who go on to become proficient and efficient readers are masters of those early literacy skills to the point of automaticity. So for example, think of yourself driving down the road. When you're driving down the road and you look at the sign next to you and it says STOP, you don't have to say to yourself, I'm going to read that word now. Just as soon as your eyes focus on that word, automatic word recognition occurs, and those neural pathways are so refined that in about 0.2 seconds, your brain recognizes that word. And this is where it becomes difficult for a lot of teachers, because what is so ingrained and automatized for us, we have to break down and teach skill by skill to someone who doesn't know it.
Kind of like the curse of knowing. We can't remember, once we're proficient at something, we can't remember what it was like to not know how to do it.
Right. It's a metaphor I often use is that in the NBA, it's very seldom that fantastic players go on to become great coaches. Often because they go onto the bench and they're like, just go be great. You know, just go out there and get it done. Whereas that's not an option for 95% of players out there, right? I think it's the same thing for teachers. It is difficult to teach what we already know to automaticity, and they become basically what I described in the first 2 minutes that I was, which is I knew to say sound it out. Mm-hmm. And then when they couldn't do that, I would say that louder.
Yeah.
Because that's the only tool I had in my toolbox at that point. But that's absolutely the biggest challenge as teachers make this shift from a more whole language approach or some approaches they've used in the past that might depend on leveled text and those types of things to explicitly teaching phonological awareness and phonics and decoding skills is the ability to take a step back and think about how do I unpack these things that I already know how to do with automaticity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really just about expanding their tool belts exponentially, right? We need a lot of tools.
Absolutely. And I have only half joked with many K and one teachers, including at Elkhart, that if you can't be excited and on about teaching the alphabet the 1,000th time, you can't teach kindergarten in this day and age.
Yeah.
A lot of times, as Ron and I discussed, when teachers would give pushback, we would hear things like, the kids are getting bored, which when we went in and did observations, often was a code for the teacher's getting bored.
Yeah. Okay.
The kids were thriving in the repetitions of practice, in the consistency, in knowing how to get things right.
Right.
But the teacher was tired of going act, cat every day.
Yeah.
So we really have to make sure that those early literacy teachers are understand the need to bring that same level of passion and enthusiasm to your 1,000th repetition of the alphabet of segmenting and blending cat, because that's what the kids need to acquire their own automaticity.
That's such a good point. I mean, I hear teachers feeling like they have to continually apologize to kids for asking them to read and write in ELA classrooms instead of just, you know, communicating that, like, this is what we do in this classroom.
Right. Standard operating procedure.
Yeah.
Right.
We read every single day. That's what we're here for.
Right.
So, yeah.
And in the best schools, as you know, that the flip side of that coin is where you walk into the math classroom and the bell work is a word problem on the board. And we're starting off math by jumping in and utilizing our reading and writing and communicating skills.
Yep. Which is typical. That's really what happens in almost every math classroom, right?
It's excellent.
Or they're doing a DBQ in their social studies classroom.
Excellent, right. And putting those reading and writing and communicating skills to use, mm-hmm. and not just, as you see in schools, more like the struggling one you mentioned before, mm-hmm. where they decide that they're going to teach their content or meet their students' needs by reading it at them.
Yeah.
Rather than teaching them to read themselves.
Yeah, they're resorting to it because they don't know what else to do because they weren't taught how to teach the kids to read.
That's right.
Our discussion today is definitely driving home the crucial need for solid early literacy instruction. And if you're searching for a pre-K through 5 comprehensive curriculum aligned to the science of reading, you'll want to learn more about today's sponsor.
This is Allison Ireland, Product Director at Reading Eggs, and we are very excited to sponsor this episode of the Ed Curation Podcast. Reading Eggs harnesses the proven power of the 5 essential pillars of the science of reading through explicit and systematic instruction. Together with highly engaging lessons and motivating rewards, students build essential reading and phonics skills with a program independently proven to improve literacy outcomes.
Find Reading Eggs from 3P Learning at edcuration.com.
Are we still learning, Dana, about the science of reading? Is there new research or is our understanding expanding on this? Are we getting better at it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
In the last 10 to 20 years, there have been major breakthroughs in basically the way fMRIs have been used to study the brain during the reading process. Anyone who would really like to nerd out on this can read about Stanislaus Dehaene's work called, his book is called Reading in the Brain. It's a little dated now, but he has many presentations online where he does a great job of unpacking how the cognitive science that he and his colleagues have uncovered really aligns with what we've known in educational research for decades as well, which is that explicit and systematic teaching of these early literacy skills often more greatly translates into better reading down the road. Really, I think of it as the cognitive science and the educational research having a nice and expanding middle of that Venn diagram where what we've learned in educational research from boots on the ground and really studying kids in classrooms is aligning with what we see happening in the brain and the study of how the brain functions during the reading process and what seems to work to teach that process more quickly.
Just FYI, I have linked some of these presentations and the research in the episode notes for your convenience.
Pretend for a minute you're brought in to coach with some teachers. You maybe have a limited amount of time or there's a limited amount of receptivity of these teachers. What would change the game for our students? Is that even a valid question to ask you?
I think, in my opinion, the biggest shift is that understanding around the need to teach the early literacy skills to automaticity and that the data should help us to make sure that that's happening. I think the more teachers understand that early literacy is about teaching those skills to the point that they can't be turned off, for example, that stop sign example, that that's really the goal of early literacy. It's not just covering the page in the curriculum. It's not just getting through short vowels. It's not just coverage. But we really have to make sure that those 5 and 6-year-olds are experiencing core curriculum interventions, supporting supplementary time in ways that result in automaticity and result in being able to do things in a way that they can't be turned off.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Do you have a sense of why this is such a hot topic the last several years?
I feel like the big breakthrough, honestly, was Emily Hanford's work, and her telling the story on NPR and really making sure that the story that we've known for a while, that there's been a huge number of extremely popular curricular programs around the country that are way out of alignment with the science of reading, or at least they were popular. We've known that for years. Emily Hanford's work really highlighted that in a way that parent groups, school boards, advocacy groups around the country grabbed a hold of and took off with. So those of us reading nerds really owe her a debt of gratitude for taking the message and shining a light on it in a way that caught hold. Her podcast and many of her articles are titled Sold a Story, mm-hmm. How Teaching Kids to Read Went So Wrong. And she really unpacks the decades that have built, led up to this moment. And she names programs, she names misalignments. She is unafraid to directly name the problem.
Emily Hanford's website, YouTube interview, and podcast are also linked in the episode notes.
She talks about how did teaching reading go so wrong? I mean, why are we in the place we're in? Why are we?
There were a lot of curricular programs that felt instinctually correct, that worked, quote unquote, for a lot of people that often already came to school with fully developed phonological processors, the ability to decode simple CVC words and some of those types of things, but they were not effective with struggling readers who did not come to school with knowledge of the ABCs, fully developed phonological processors, and the ability to decode. So because these programs showed oftentimes around 30-40% effectiveness with kids who came to school able to read, they persisted.
What do we do with those kids who didn't get this in elementary school? How do we catch them up? We can't structure our middle school classrooms around teaching the alphabet for, 40% of our kids, can we?
No, I don't think that we can just completely restructure middle schools and high schools, but I do think that there's a place for making sure that those students' needs are met. Like I mentioned around having a struggling reader class or an intervention class. I do think that simply moving forward and teaching teachers how to provide ways to help students access grade level text, I don't think that puts the needs of the students first and foremost. I think that there needs to be a two-pronged approach. I think we need to address their often word level needs while continuing to teach them grade level vocabulary skills and using those word level skills in grade level texts. So the ability to decode can and should be used in those multisyllabic words across the curriculum. A lot of the alphabet soup, as we call them in my graduate classes, of different ways we can structure before, during, and after reading activities to help facilitate comprehension for all students.
Got it. Yeah. So going back to your step one, the curriculum step, Ed Curation, we're a marketplace, and we do have district leaders and educators reach out to us all the time, trying to find what will be the best fit and the highest quality resources for their schools and their districts. And I'm just curious, when curriculum directors or leaders are looking for their reading programs, what questions should they be asking?
Well, I am happy that you asked that. I am doing this work a lot around Colorado. For those who don't know, Colorado, like many states, has a piece of legislation that is now requiring schools to move towards a core curriculum that is selected off of an approved list that the Department of Education puts out, and that list is all aligned to the science of reading. One of the things that districts really need to do, I think, is the first step is develop your team, get your team of literacy leaders together, whether it's school level or district level, and then make sure that you are utilizing a common language and, in my opinion, a common resource. For example, I almost always recommend the use of the curriculum review tool offered for free by the Reading League. It is aligned to the science of reading. It is connected to Scarborough's Rope and the sections of Scarborough's Rope, and helps teachers to be able to apply those things to curricula through specific questions at each grade level. So making sure that you're really using a consistent tool and have a consistent background of understanding of the people reviewing is critical to arriving at a shared understanding of what's best for your students.
Yeah, I like that. I think this is important to note. Oftentimes, curriculum companies provide a certain amount of professional learning with their curriculum, but that professional learning is basically how to implement this curriculum, right? It's how the lessons proceed and what resources are included. It's not necessarily the kind of strategies and practices that Sterling Literacy supports.
Absolutely. Make sure that you're going to cover the science of reading. And what we try to help teachers do is make sure that they are implementing with some of the art of teaching as well. So, for example, an example might be if I'm working with students and we're working on segmenting and blending CBC words, and I recognize at the end of my 7 words that 2 of my students are still struggling. I might take 1 or 2 minutes and double back and do a couple more words just so I get more repetitions of practice, because I know as a teacher that the repetitions of practice are what results in the refined neural pathways that are required for automaticity.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would love for our listeners to know that I didn't ask you?
I would like to just reiterate is that although there's been a lot of emphasis around making sure that we have professional development aligned to the science of reading for teachers, in my experience, a lot of it is as successful as the individual teacher wants it to be until we get to the point where the principal and or district level leaders are also receiving the same training, the same understandings, and they're able to go into their observations understanding what the science of reading should look like in action. The greater ownership the school and district level leaders have around the knowledge of the science of reading and how that's connecting to their classroom practices and observations, the more successful this movement's going to be.
If you think that your school or district would benefit from the kinds of support offered by Dr. Charles Dana Hall and Sterling Literacy Consulting, you can find Dr. Hall on LinkedIn or reach out through his website at sterlingliteracy.org. Or, even easier, you can find all of those links in the episode notes, along with all the research and resources discussed in the episode. You'll also find a link to today's sponsor, Reading Eggs, a comprehensive literacy curriculum for pre-K through grade 5, fully aligned to the science of reading. Second grade teacher Stacy DeZormo from St. Mark Catholic School in North Carolina said, "I have observed after 32 years of teaching that this program definitely brings progress to all readers. My students enjoy the games, reading the stories, and completing assignments at home." You can learn more about Reading Eggs at edcuration.com. Simply search Reading Eggs and click the Let's Talk button to learn more and get a free trial. Ed Curation is part of the Education Podcast Network, where you'll find similar shows. And you can find us pretty much anywhere podcasts are found, along with additional content on our website and our YouTube channel. If you found this episode helpful, we hope you'll take a minute to like, comment, and share. And if you have a topic or a tool that you would like to share with our EdCuration audience, simply reach out to us through the comments or at our website. Thanks for joining us today, and we hope you'll come back for our next episode of Reshaping Learning with the EdCuration Podcast.